And we have to have a living answer to a living problem. Now, just before lunch, we covered a specific phase. The area of business. And now we are going to cover the area of home and personal relationships. Individual relationships. What is to be our attitude and our effort in our own homes? About a year ago, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago or something, I was talking to Maximum and the Grasshopper. Was talking in Minimum over Chino. And Maximum gets out a half hour before Minimum, and then we could go on over and spend the rest of the time in the other meeting. And in case you don't know who the Grasshopper is, Eddie Cochran. Eddie Cochran. And so that meeting got over and we started for the coffee spa. And Eddie was chattering like a damn monkey. And he says, we went to a meeting the other night. And they asked if there were any beginners there, any new people there. Whose hand went up? He says, whose hand went up? And I said, no. He says, my wife. He says, I finally took this thing home. I guess he'd been in already sober 10 years. And he'd finally taken it home. And his wife would declare herself in. And I had been married for 20 years prior to my demise and rebirth. And in the entire 20 years, she couldn't please me. She had never pleased me. From the very beginning, she had never been able to please me. Because what she did, she was supposed to do, wasn't she? She was the wife of the great chamberlain. You know? And what she did, she was supposed to do. And what she didn't do, I got gypped. She didn't love me enough. You know? And she simply couldn't please me. We didn't have any real bad times together, except over the liquor. But it was just the unrest, the never being really satisfied and happy with a lot, with my lot. Well, she had considered breaking up the little partnership for some time, but had never been able to bring herself around to it until the last trip out. And she had finally decided that kids better not have any father than have a drunken father. So she had sought counsel to legally rid the household of something they hadn't had for a long time anyway. Me. Now, the only
anything that she'd ever been prepared to do in life, besides being a good wife and mother, was in the theatrical business. She was very good. That's where the kid gets his stuff. And marrying me had scotched that. And it was 20 years too late by this time. And so she had to have some way of feeding those kids and her mother who lived with us. So she went out and started a business course. She thought that having been a good pianist, the typing would be very easy for her. She ought to pick that up in a hurry. And so she was going to learn how to type and keep books and the like so she could feed the kids. Well, she brought a typewriter home with her, put it on the table, you know, out in the dining room. And I'd be laying back in that bedroom. She's out there pecking the hell out of this typewriter. Well, it didn't do very much for my nerves. But as drunk as I was, I knew that she'd never make it. She'd never be a typist as long as she lives. And this didn't do anything good for my insides either. Might have been one of the things that helped me finally get to the program. I don't know. But I had this little experience that we talked about this morning, middle of January, 46. And I called this woman in after I had gotten to a place where I could talk. And I said to her, "Honey, it's no longer of any consequence to me whether I live under this roof or someplace else. It is absolutely of no importance to me at all. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as the two of us live but one. If I can ever add anything to your life, let me do it." And we closed the book. And neither one of us knew what we were talking about. And I called the boys in. And I said, "Boys, there's no father in the household any longer. You don't need to love me, you don't need to respect me, and you don't need to obey me. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as you live but one. If I ever have anything, be it money, counsel, or blood, that will add to your life, let me give it to you." And we closed that book. And it was never reopened. And inasmuch as there is no way that we can change a thought or act of yesterday, there was no sense in dwelling on that end of the deal. What had been done was done. And so my intent was to do something for them now. And I started trying to do it, to add to their lives. And again, with no expectancy. I never had any more thought that that household would be put back together than I had planned to move. And for my first 6 months in the program, I never even talked with them about AA. I never said a damn word to them about it. I'd put on my hat and I'd go to an AA meeting. And I'd come back home and think about it all night. Very little sleep. And then I'd do what I could the next day and go to another meeting. But I never spoke with them about it at all. I did, however, buy the book the first meeting I went to, and I brought it home. And unknown to me, she read the book. Not once, but probably many times. And I never said anything to them about the program until the 6 months period was over. And I had awakened to the fact that I was sober and had been all the time. And then I started to take Mrs. C with me to meetings. She indicated that she'd like to go. And I think the second great awakening, the first being the awakening that I was sober and had been all the time. The second one was that something had happened in the household. There wasn't any fighting anymore. There wasn't any blue papers passing around. And there was just a new house somehow or another. And somehow, the woman was, for the first time in my life, very satisfactory. She didn't have to do anything. There were no demands. She didn't have to be there. She didn't have to come or go or cook or clean or anything else. And she did them. And it was a plus. She didn't have to. Formerly, it was a demand. That was her business, you know. She was my wife. And now, there were no demands, and she was doing it. And so it was a plus. And so this thing put itself together. And we've had 17 of the most wonderful years you ever heard tell of. Same woman. The same kids. Now, we were talking this morning about giving each other the right to make our own mistakes. I believe this has to go through every relationship, including our own wives and our own kids. We have to give them the same right that we have. I believe we said this morning that God loved us enough to allow us to make our own mistakes, that we might the sooner run out of our own resources and come back home. Now, we've got to carry this thing through on the family level also. We've got to give our wives and our kids the right to make their own mistakes. We've got to give them the right to find their own answers, even as you and I had to find ours. I remember probably about the end of the first year we'd gone to a meeting, and I talked a little bit. And it's the first time she'd ever heard me talk in an AA meeting. And it was just a very short thing. And I ended the talk by saying that if it were necessary for me to go home and pack my little grip and go to Tibet in order to maintain what I had found. I would go immediately home and pack my grip, and I'd come to the living room and I'd kiss my wife goodbye. And I would say, honey, I'm sorry. I've got to go. And I just said it because it was true. And we got home. And I was sitting in a big chair, and she was sitting over in the Davenport. And pretty soon, I became conscious of the fact that she was falling apart. She was just crying her heart out. And I said to her, "Why, honey, what's the matter? What's here?" And she said, "Oh, what you said." She said, "Here, for the first time in her life, we have a chance for a little peace and a little happiness. And you say you'd pack up and go to bed." She says, "Don't I mean anything to you? Don't the kids mean anything to you?" And she just broke all up. And so I let her cry until she quit. And I says, "Honey, am I worth anything to you, drunk?" And she says, "No." "Am I worth anything to the kids, drunk?" "No." "Am I worth anything to life, drunk?" And she says, "No." Well, I said, "Then can't you see that this has to be first? I can't live and drink. Of myself, I can't keep from drinking. Can't you see that this has to be number one in my life?" Well, she couldn't. But it came to pass. And it wasn't too long until she was saying that to her people, just the same. Possession, but not the necessity to possess. Love includes possession, but not the necessity to possess. The necessity to possess is an ego satisfaction. This is an ego thing. And as such, it is my will. The necessity to possess. But possession, the mutual givingness of peoples to each other in love, this is normal and natural and good. But the necessity to possess is the killer. And so the relationship changed completely. Now, as time went on, having given up the authority in the beginning, because, you see, due to the very nature of the alcoholic, his demands were great. Being perfectionists, as all of us are, we not only demanded perfection out of ourselves and didn't give it, but we demanded it out of everybody around us. And if we didn't get it, we got hurt by it. The demand for perfection out of those around us, it goes with the perfectionistic nature of the alcoholic. And so, we attempted to force it. I damn near ruined the woman and the kids. Demanding perfection out of them. I had those two boys, so they were almost afraid to pick up a football or a basketball or a baseball. Because I wanted them to be all Americans. You know? All that stuff was simple and easy for me. I was a born athlete. And I just raised Ned with them. I'd show them how to do a thing, and when they didn't do it, I was on them like a tent. And I had them scared to death. Same way with doing something. I wanted them to get busy. You see, I was a self-made man. And I wouldn't let anybody forget it. I was born with a pitchfork in my hand. And I made my own way from the time I was 13. And you, these monkeys of mine, wouldn't even get a paper route. You know? And I was beating them to get the hell out there and do something, you know? And I just damn near ruined them, really. Well, the accident of failure and giving up the authority and giving them the right to make their own mistakes. And pretty soon coming to realize that the only right any one of us have to teach at any level, including the home, is by example. This is the only right any of us have to teach. By example. Not by word or authority, but by example. And so it wasn't very long until they were bringing me their problems. Those kids were bringing me their problems. And I would listen to them and I would say to them, well, I think I'd do it this way. This seems to me to be the right approach to it, but you don't have to do it this way. Do it your own way. And as a consequence, they bring anything. When it came time for old Bill to get married, he came to me and he says, Dad, I want to know everything you know about a woman. My own son. And by George, I told him. We spent all night and talked. And I withheld nothing. But now these are the things we're looking at and talking about. An attitude in the home. Giving our people, our closest people, the right to live their own lives and make their own mistakes and learn in their own way. Now, after about 7 years, I guess I was sober, Al-Anon came along. And Mrs. C had already seen that going with me to meetings wasn't doing it for her. And when this Al-Anon deal came along, she got in it hook, line, and sinker. And she is more active in her work, I think, than I am in mine. Because she has days to work at it. She started a group in our living room in Beverly. Went from two or three to a house full, and they had to get a hall to meet in. And they're still going good. And she started a group as soon as we got located in Laguna Beach. Met in our living room for two or three years. Got up to 45 women. And then they had to get a haul down there. But you see, she is going down the same road that I am going, but in her own path, in her own way. And so we're walking down the same road together, but not too close together, giving each other the right to make our own mistakes. Now, we're going to carry this thing all the way through. Not only in the family, but all the way through. And this program somehow teaches us why people do the things that they do. You see, we're inclined to think that we're the only people that are obsessed. We got an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. We're alcoholics. You know? But we don't give other people the right to be obsessed. They have just as many obsessions as we do. And we got to come to see that people don't act like they act because they want to, but because they have to. We quickly tell you that we drank against our own will. You know, we decided to quit drinking. Sincere as hell. You know, but we were drunk that night. Because of the obsession, you know? But how about giving the other guy the right to a few obsessions, too? And when we come to see this, we know why people act like they act. And therefore, the hurt's gone out of it. You see, when people used to try to tear us down, we had to straighten them out. Sometimes we got the hell kicked out of ourselves. But it didn't stop the crusade. We lost a few battles, but we never lost a war. You know? We had to straighten them out. I'm mindful of one of my old drinking buddies, just Ted Vaughn, Vaughn's Markets. And we used to run around together a great deal with our families. And Ted was a hell of a good drinker, still is. And the drunker he got, the more dignified he got. And just before he'd fall on his face, he was as dignified as Napoleon, you know? Absolutely proper in everything. And my wife made the mistake of saying to me, "Oh, why can't you drink like Ted?" Well, I immediately had a project. I had to get the guy drunk right in front of her, see? So drunk he couldn't hit the floor with his hat. Well, I didn't have anything against him. I love the guy, still do. But I had to show my wife that that guy was as bad a drunk as me. And so I tripled him. Now, this is what I'm talking about. Why people do what they do. Many of you have heard me use this little example. Shows you the difference. here a little while back. I was talking at Ohio Street, Santa Monica. And it was on a weekend, and I'd come all the way up from Laguna and been drinking coffee all day, so my first stop was the little boys' room. And I went in there, and there was a guy in there. And he looked up and saw me, and he says, "Oh," says, "you you talking here tonight?" And I says, "Big yeah." Well, he says, "Wish I'd known it, going to Malibu." And then he says, "Well, you still got time." And I just so happens, I got enough money here in my pocket to pay your taxi fare. Call a cab and run up to Malibu. They'll have a good meeting up there tonight. Oh, he says, "You know, I was just kidding." And he turned to go out, but he never made it. He came back and he says, "Chuck," he says, "do you know how you ruin every talk you ever make for me?" And I said, "No, I'd be interested." But he says, "You take your coat off." Well, I says, "That's another good reason for you to go to Malibu." I said, "Tonight it's a little bit warm, and I'm liable to slip out of that jacket most any time." Oh, he says, "Don't kid me." He says, "You don't take off that coat because you're hot. You do it to make an impression." He says, "You're a public speaker. I'm a public speaker, too, and I know." Well, he turned and walked out. Well, there's been a time when he couldn't have gotten out of that place with a tooth in his head. I wouldn't even turn around. I just swung at the sound. But the thing that happened this time, my insides said to me, "The boy's hurting. The boy's hurting. I hope something will come out tonight that will might give him a clue. And maybe he'll get some help in this area." Now you see the difference. We simply got to come to see that people don't act like they act because they want to, but because they have to, just as we drank. Because we had to. And we give them the right to their own opinion, and we give them the right to make their own mistakes. And it isn't necessary then for us to make them over. And if we're living these principles, if we're practicing these principles in all of our affairs, one day at a time, pretty soon they're coming to us with their problems. And they're asking us, because it's no longer necessary, you see, for us to tell them. This is fabulous. A teacher don't have to look for pupils. They seek out the teacher. And the only right we have to teach is by example. Now, let's look at the change in relationships in its entirety, at the whole picture. Many of you have heard me tell this too, but it bears repeating. I had talked in St. Louis at the annual banquet about 6 years ago. Seven. And it was a big thing. Father Ed Dowling was there. Father Ed, as most of you know, was not an alcoholic. But he was acquainted with this thing. He heard about it early and went back to New York to meet Bill in the very early days. And he loved this thing. And he was in it, but not of it, until his death, just shortly before our 25th anniversary. Now, I'd heard Father Ed talk, and I loved him, and he had heard me before this particular thing, and I think he loved me a bit. And so after the thing was over, Mrs. C says, let's ask Father Ed to have coffee with us. And I said, well, I think that'd be wonderful if he'd do it. And being an alcoholic, I said, you ask him. She did. And so help me, he accepted. And we went and sat down in the booth. And this guy started asking questions. And he never quit. And I would say to him, Father, I've talked all evening. You talk. Let me listen. And he'd ask another question. And the last question that he asked was about the family. And I said, well, Mrs. C's here. We'll let her answer this one. And Mrs. C told him what had happened in the family. And the guy sat with his mouth pursed up, as was his wont, looking off into space for seemingly 5 minutes. Then he turned around and he says, you know something, Chuck? And I said, what, Father? And he says, sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. Sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. And I looked at my wife and I says, honey, where is the difference? Where is the difference? Because that's exactly what this program does for us. It gives us a new pair of glasses. We don't see as we used to see. We don't hear as we used to hear. We don't act as we used to act. We are not motivated as we used to be motivated. The whole thing is turned around. We have a new pair of glasses. All the relationships of life are different. We come to see ourselves in all men, and all men in ourselves. Now, as strange as it might seem, I sat in the same chair, in the same living room, with the same wife and the same kids for 10 years in hell and 11 years in heaven. The same chair in the same living room with the same wife and the same kids. 10 years in hell and 11 years in heaven. And then we moved to Laguna. And the chair didn't match. And they put it back in the den. And it took me about 5 years to get it back out in the living room. But I got it back there now, and I'm still sitting in the same chair. Now, this is what we're talking about. This is what this whole thing has been about. How come you can sit in the same chair in the same living room with the same woman and the same kids? Hell and heaven. New pair of glasses. A new pair of glasses. How long has it been since I've seen a drunk? Been 10 years. It's been 10 years since I've seen a drunk. And yet every time I go downtown, I go down to the end of Fifth Street. I pick up Fifth. Central Avenue. and go west. I'm drawn as a magnet. Every time I go downtown, that's my route. And nearly every time I pull into Fifth Street, the Black Mariah is there. I know that thing. I know her inside out. I've ridden in her in chains. And here she comes with the rag pickers. And the wino sees it. And he tries to make his getaway. The one, you know, that's got the fifth in a brown bag so nobody will know what he's got. And he tries to escape. Maybe he's not navigating very good, and maybe he hits the street about five times before he gets in the alley. But he never moves that box. And he gets in the alley, and I'm glad. Because that's me, but with the grace of God. That's me. I don't see a wino. I see me, but with the grace of God. And I go on down the street, and here sits the old boy in the doorway. It's July, and he's got his black overcoat on. He's got a half a fifth sitting there with his red eye. And he's laughing and talking with his friends. His friends aren't there. I can't hardly pass him by. I can't hardly go by. I want to get out and leave the car sitting there and sit down and pull him over on my lap. And then him, look, brother, there's a better way. See, I used to wear my overcoat in July. I used to meet the people and talk with them, and they talked to me, and they went around. This was one of the most difficult things that my family had to put up with. We'd all be sitting in the same living room, and I'd have company, and they wouldn't have any. That's me, but with the grace of God. The new pair of glasses. And so we come to see that every man that lives is doing the best he can according to his light. That is, according to his understanding. Every man that lives is doing the best he can according to his light. That is, according to his understanding. Why don't I steal? Because I know I can steal from nobody but me. Can't steal from anybody but me. There's no necessity of it. Why don't I hate? I can't afford it. I can't afford the penalty. Why don't I judge? I can't afford it. Why don't I condemn? I can't afford it. I am unwilling to pay the inevitable price that goes with it. Because I know better now. I've got a new pair of glasses. And now this, then, is going to be the last of this series of lessons. I'm going to throw a little thing at you to think about and play with. It is my opinion that the only bondage there
is total and absolute freedom under law. The only bondage there is total and absolute freedom under law. There is no law of God or man that says I can't drink liquor. There is no law that says I can't drink liquor. It's free, as far as I'm concerned. I'm free to drink. It's legal in California. And I got enough money in my pocket to buy a whole passel of it right now. A whole gob of it. By the grace of God, through the miracle of AA. I wouldn't have it very long if I had one. But there's no law that says I can't. Why don't I? Because I am not willing to pay the inevitable price. No bondage but freedom. I can think and do as I please as long as I am willing to pay the inevitable penalty of my thought and act. Now, the freedom then does not include license. It isn't enough that I say, all right, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. We were talking about this just before the meeting. It's my head that hurts. You know, I'm not hurting. I'm still paying the bills. Leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. No. Freedom doesn't include license because, again, here's the operation of the law. Justice without judgment. And I can't afford to pay the penalty. There's a man whom I knew and whom many of you know and have heard. I met him several years before he decided he was an alcoholic and heard him talk in another area of life. And I thought he was a bombastic, egotistical ass. And we had a symposium on alcoholism. This might be 12 years ago or 14 at UCLA. And Dr. Jelinek was here from the New York School of Alcoholic Studies and a lot of others. And I attended this thing, and this guy happened to be teaching at UCLA at the time, and he was the moderator of this symposium. Well, before the symposium was over, this guy decided to declare himself in. He's an alcoholic. And so he started coming to meetings. And here I wanted to get rid of this thing I had about the guy. Because he did something bad to me. And I used to go clear across town to get to hear him. To see if I wouldn't change my mind. And I had it pretty near licked. Really, I did. So one night we dropped into Motion Picture Group over in Hollywood. And the first speaker that night was Zach Turton, and Zach was from my home group. You remember Zach.
And I said to my wife, honey, isn't it nice we came? We haven't heard Jack for quite a while, and this is great. And Jack got up and gave a nice talk, and we were tickled. And then he sat down, and this guy got up. And it was shortly after the controversy here in town about who held the first meeting and who brought the first book and who got sober first and all that stuff, you know. And this guy gets up and he talks about 10 minutes on honesty. What a great thing it was, you know, to be honest. And then he says, so-and-so says so-and-so bought the first book out here. That's a lie! And you can meet him with about 400 people and a lot of new ones in it. And it just pretty near killed me. And he'd say, so-and-so says so-and-so had the first meeting. That's a lie! And then he'd go ahead and tell who did it. And this went on for the whole time. And when the meeting was over, I said to Mrs. T, honey, let's go home. I want to take a shower. And she said, you just had a shower. And I said, I know, but I'm dirty. Let's go home. And we went home, and I took a shower. And I'm in the shower with the water beating on me. And a thing went through my mind. And it says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And the old boy slid off my back. And he's never been there since. And nobody else has ever been there. You see, I can't afford to carry these guys. I can't afford a resentment. I can't afford judgment. I can't afford hate. I can't afford lies and deceit. These things I cannot afford because I can't be comfortable with myself and do them. No bondage but freedom. Wouldn't it be funny? Wouldn't it be a great cosmic joke if this thing were true? That the thing we have always been searching for, we have been searching with, that the God that we have always been searching for has been with us forever. And all we have to do is get rid of the debris, uncover, and discover. Isn't it an amazingly wonderful thought to think there is no bondage but freedom? Now, what then is my chore out here? In all my comings and goings, in every avenue of my life, what is my chore out here? What is my business? My business is to go about my Father's business. That's the only business I got. To share my experience, strength, and hope with anybody that wants. Because I want to. This is my business out here. Now, what is my business with me? Who is the Pope's Pope? You know? Who is the preacher's preacher? Where am I to go? I can't blame God. I can't blame the devil. I can't blame you. I can't blame circumstances and conditions.
Where am I to go when things are not well with me? I have to come to myself. Now, my business is very simple out here. But what's my business with me? My business with me is to sit off a mile away and look at me and see what I can do and be comfortable inside and do those things, accentuate those things, and to see what I cannot do and be comfortable with myself and eliminate those things. Because I must be comfortable in here. If I am not comfortable with me, the next thing I know, I'll reach for the drink. And I'll wake up with an empty glass in my hand. I always did. When I was not comfortable with me, and that big hurt was in here, I had to get rid of it. And the only way I knew was to drink. And so it's most important that I stay comfortable with me. And here again, to be honest enough to see ourselves and to see our motivation in all departments and to eliminate the things we can't do. And be comfortable. This is my business with me. And I have to do it. There's no other way that I can live. I have to do it. This is my business with me. And so this takes the whole business of living. The living out here, my business out here. And the living in here, my business in here. Now, this one last remark. It's this simple with me. I'm either going to run my life and take the consequences, or I'm not going to run it and take the consequences. You can't do both. The carpenter says you can't serve two masters. A house divided against itself can't stand. We gotta see one or the other. You can't mix them. It's like mixing oil and water. This is one of the great fallacies in most of this inspirational reading that we get now. For instance, a book like Peale's book, The Power of Positive Thinking. Now, this is a hell of a book. Lots of people that aren't alkies can read that book and get a lot out of it. But an alky can't. Because this is taking a little spiritual stuff and mixing it with a little material stuff and coming out with a better product. Well, that don't work with us. We gotta either make one move or the other. Either I'm gonna run my life and take the consequences, or I am not gonna run it and take the consequences. But now I can't run it. I'm an alcoholic. I cannot run it. And therefore, there's nothing in me that even wants to. I don't want to try. I had my innings. I ran it for 43 years and wrecked the whole deal. So I can't run it. So I'm not going to run it. I'm going to not run it and take the consequences. And so, how am I going to do that? Just by this very simple little thing I just told you. I'm going to go about my father's business out here to the best of my ability, one day at a time, because I want to. And I'm going to clean up in here to the best of my ability so that I will be comfortable with myself and let the chips fall where they may. Now, I will close by saying I never had it so good. This is the only easy life I have ever known, and I'm 60 years old. This is the only good life that has ever been mine in my entire lifetime. And I never had it for good. It's my business to walk in this way, and it's God's business to take care of it. And I don't interfere with him. I just let him do it. God bless you all.
Thank you. Where I've been, or how I've been there, and I don't know today. By next to the last drunk, I drove 6,000 miles in a blackout. I drove from Beverly Hills to Louisville, Kentucky, to North Michigan, and back of the coast. And I don't remember 5% of it. And you can't hardly do that sober. And so when we get to a point where we can see and read the lessons that are before us, we have to see that something was taken care of us long before we ever got into this program. Now, it might not have had too much to do with us. Maybe it did, because most of us were searchers. Most of us were trying to find answers. I suspect most of you read the little excerpts. The letter from Bill, for instance, to Dr. Carl Jung that appeared in the Grapevine. I think it was in January's Grapevine. And then there was another doctor back, I think he was back in 1785 or 1875 or something like that, that was talking about the illness, the search of the alcoholic. Long before Alcoholics Anonymous ever was thought of, even the liquor experience for the alcoholic was included in this search, this trying to get back to the oneness of life. And when we are away from the liquor long enough to look at ourselves and our lives, we see that on many, many, many occasions, some power took care of us. And I'm one who believes that this could be very easily, because of the prayers of our non-alcoholic friends, those who loved us and were interested in our well-being and prayed for us, that maybe our very lives were saved because of somebody else's prayers. And maybe they were saved because of our own search. While you're writing a question, I'll tell you this story. Some 10 years ago, I was to be the
main liner in Folsom Prison. It was the yearly conference up there. And I was going to be the main speaker. And I don't know how many of you have been to one of these conferences inside Folsom, but it's quite a big thing. It's a meeting that lasts 3 or 4 hours. And they have inmates talking and outmates talking, and the representatives, the governors there, and the parole boards there, and the wardens there, and it's quite a thing. Well, this thing went along, and eventually it came my turn. But there's only 15 minutes left. And here I am, the main liner. And so Warden Hines gets up and takes 2 minutes of the 15 apologizing. But he says we've got to get out of there before the changing of the guards, and he can't possibly give us any more time. We simply got to get out. And so I've got 13 minutes. And I get up, and something comes out that turns the prison over. I don't know what it was. I've never heard it. They recorded it. They've got it up there, and they still talk about it. But I don't know what it was. But it turned the doggone prison over. And we never did get out on time because I couldn't get out of the room. Those guys were fighting to touch me. It was an amazing experience. And the next day I was flying home, and I was alone, and I was sitting up 15,000 feet in the air. And I got to looking at this thing. Because it was a fabulous thing. And I was looking at it. And the first thing that hit me real hard was that the only possibility for identity with that bunch of men was because of the life I led. And this hit hard, you see. The only possibility for that identity, that great identity that had been in that room, was because of the life I led. And the next thing that hit me was this, that in my early youth in the hills of Kentucky in southern Indiana, my childhood dream was to live with the gangsters and woo them back to the kingdom. This was just when the gangster era was coming in, you know. And I was going to live with the gangsters right in their holes and woo them back to the kingdom. This was my great dream as a kid. And in essence, this is now my life. This is what I'm doing. And so the next thing that hit me was the thread of a life. The thread of a life. Now, if there were anything to be gained by rationalization, I would say that this little story that I'm now telling is rationalization. Trying to rationalize a misspent youth. You know. But there's nothing to be gained. I'm not going any place. I got nothing to prove. Nothing to argue about. And so there's nothing to be gained. So I don't think it's rationalization. So this thing, the thread of a life. Now here I am, doing the very thing, in essence, that I dreamed of doing as a child. So who can say that the schooling that was necessary didn't have to come before the fruition of the dream? You see? I cannot say, and I don't think anybody can say, that that 25 years of drinking, including the 10 years of hell, wasn't a necessary part of the preparation for the fulfillment of the dream. Now, one thing more, and then the question, if there's one. The world would say that that 25 years were bad. The world would say that the last 10 years was awful. This was a very bad thing. I say it was good. I say it was good. Because out of the worst possible life came the best. So I almost blessed the bottle. I almost blessed the bottle. Because it finally beat me to death. And I could then fulfill the conditions that made this life possible. You see it? And who says it was good or bad? Who can say? I wouldn't change 30 seconds of it if it were in my power to do so. Now, that's one thing for an alcoholic who has been returned from the land of the living dead and the land of the living. It's one thing for the alcoholic to say this. But when the non-alcoholic wife and when the non-alcoholic kids also say that they wouldn't change a second of it. This seems to have some meaning. This seems to have a great significance to it. And insofar as I'm able to perceive, this thread of a life deal might well explain the whole thing. Take that and smoke it in your pipe. Read the question, please. Read it.
Tell your mother-in-law, Joe.
This is a good place for it. We've been too serious. Seems to be a place for pretty nearly everything. I have a great laugh about me. People tell me all over the country that I'm the most quoted man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it just tickles the hell out of me. Because I have talked about someplace between 4,000 and 5,000 times in AA. And I've never said an original thing yet. I have stolen everything I've said. I get a little here and a little there and put them together and I say it. And I'm the most quoted man in the deal. Not yet have I ever said an original thing. And this mother-in-law story tickles me a great deal. I stole this from Al Badger. He does. But it makes a point to me. The time must come with us when we see that if there be fault, it is ours. If there be fault, it's mine. Now, the little story that I just told you would tend to make you think I believe that I don't think there's fault. I don't. I don't think there's fault. I think we are the victims of the combination of characteristics with which we were born. And we have to have answers, and we can't find them. And so we get in a mess. And we finally, if we find this program and stick with it, we find our answers. And then we're able to live as we've always wanted to live. So I don't believe there's fault. And the time must come when we have no excuses left. You see, if an alcoholic has an excuse that's still acceptable to him, he's got another drunk left. It's unthinkable for an alcoholic to toss in the towel, to surrender, when he can still pin this thing on somebody else. If it's still your mother-in-law's fault, you got another drunk left. And my mother-in-law was my last excuse. We had a mutual hating society that was terrific. And so, this little story. Al says that these two drunks met on the street, and one of them said to the other, "How are things?" Oh, he says, "Not good." But he says, "That's bad." Oh, he says, "Not so bad. They got married." Well, he says, "That's good." Oh, he says, "Not so good. I got my mother-in-law, too." Well, he says, "That's bad." He says, "Not so bad. She's got money." Well, he says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good. She wants to boss everything." Well, he says, "That's bad." He says, "Not so bad. She bought us a house." Well, he says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good. The house burned down." Well, he says, "That sure is bad." He says, "Not so bad, brother." He says, "She burned, too." And so I like to use that, because the last excuse has got to burn out. We must come to see that if there be fault, it is mine. Honest enough to see this. If there be fault, it is mine. And then honest enough to do something about it. Namely, to practice these principles in all of our affairs one day at a time. And when we do that, something happens, and we don't have to drink anymore. That's the mother-in-law story. What's next?
Going back to giving credit where credit is due, you know, remember when I first came on the program, when I pick up something from you or somebody else, and I would always give a credit line, you know? Well, one night I'm talking to you, and you said, "Well, why did you do that?" And I said, "Well, I listened to a lot of programs." "Well, it was mine until you used it, and now it's yours, so you don't..."
Yeah.
Old Roy, I remember this.
Old Roy Jurgen says that the only way he can tell whether a story that he uses is any good or not is if I steal it. And then he says, "When I steal it, he can't use it anymore because I'm always ahead of it. I'm just stolen." I'm going to tell what it is, but just tickled me to death. And it makes a point, too. Roy is about 6 feet 6 high and about as wide as that thing there.